Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish the book, I do a review and put it up online. So, good feedback from the last episode. A little bit of news here. Good feedback from the last episode, mainly because I said, send me emails about X, and X was, how did you find the show? And quite a few people did email me, and it was good, because I found it different ways that people have found the show over the past year that I've been recording. Which is pretty cool. Also, I asked for volunteers to read my own novella story attempt, however you define novel or novella, if it's just word count or is it the overall view of the book, I don't know. Anyway, so I said I'd actually print it out and send to people, but in the end most people just emailed back and say, oh no, just send it to me as a text file or a HTML file, and that's what I did. So 8 people now have copies of my novel, and I'm hoping they're going to send back some interesting feedback. No feedback yet for anyone who's actually finished the story yet, but otherwise they're looking good there. I'm hoping for lots of good feedback. In other news, my leg, the trapped nerve in my leg, sciatic nerve in my leg, is feeling a whole lot better, which is cool. And another cool thing in my life at the moment is that I've always wanted to go to Africa, and it's the last continent that I've never been to. So next month I'm going there, so I'm really interested to go to, I think it's Mauritius, Madagascar, Tanzania and Kenya. And I'll be doing that in February, so I'm really looking forward to that as well. So life is looking up at the moment. I'm going to new places, and I'm feeling a lot better. So let's get straight on now to the book that I'm going to review today, and it is, of course, by Peter F. Hamilton, and it's The Temporal Void. Now, little bit background on this. I have actually reviewed... This is a second part in a trilogy of books, and I have reviewed the first part in this trilogy called The Dreaming Void. I did that back in episode number... I must have been around about 28 or 30 or something like that. So check that one out. No, it is episode 30, I remember now. So if you want to know more about the world that this is set up and a lot more about the background of that of this trilogy, it's probably best to listen to that review first and then come back and listen to this one if you're interested in this book. Otherwise, what I'm going to do now is something very tricky. I'm going to try to review a book which is the second book in a trilogy without spoiling the first book in the trilogy, but it's made even more complicated because the trilogy itself isn't the first trilogy, or it's not the first story set in this universe. For example, the universe was set up in the first book in this universe was written years and years ago. It's called Misspent Youth, which is a pretty good book. And then there was two other books set hundreds of years after that one. One called Pandora's Star, I think it is, and Judas Unchained, which is just a pair of books and a full story there as well. Which was the first one. I really enjoyed Pandora's Star. Judas Unchained was pretty good, not as good as the first one though. And then along came The Dreaming Void, that was released, I think, in 2007, and then in 2008. Just a few months ago, was released this book, The Temporal Void. I don't think it's out in America yet, as far as I can see online. It's coming out in a few months' time, so maybe if you've already tried out The Dreaming Void, and then you're wondering, hey, should I actually buy and read The Temporal Void again? Well, hopefully I can answer those questions today in this review. So, like I say, I'm going to try and review this book without spoiling The Dreaming Void and without spoiling the other books set in the same universe. So it's going to be a little bit tricky. So, again, I'm not going to set up the whole world of the book here because it doesn't really change a whole lot from the first book. Of course, it's set in the same universe. And I talked mostly about the universe and the level of technology and the setup there. So in this book, again, lots of characters returning from the previous book. But of course, these characters were around in the previous books again, back in Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. And a lot more return into this book, and there's references to other events in there. Now, I was thinking before that, hey, maybe you could read The Dreaming Void without reading Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. It might spoil those books for you, but you'd still be able to get a lot out of The Dreaming Void. But now I'm into The Temple Void, I realise that, no, actually, you do need to have read Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. Misspent Youth, not so much, but you do need to read those other books leading up to these books in advance, because it's like, the previous books don't just create a big backdrop, a real great sense of history for these. They are actually influencing the storylines and the events and things that are coming up in these books. You'd only understand what's going on. You'd only get the references and the hints to what's going on if you've read Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. So I do recommend them. They are pretty good books, especially Pandora's Star. So, again, get into this book without spoiling the others. A bit tricky. So, let's go straight to it. The story, then. It comes down to this. There's a huge void in the centre of the galaxy, which we all thought was a big black hole, and it turns out it's not a big black hole. It's a different kind of singularity, some kind of intelligent, technological kind of singularity, and it's huge. And any time anything goes close to it, it's destroyed, and nobody really knows what it is. The thing is, it expands at different points, so sometimes it's this size, and then suddenly it'll go, and it'll grow a bit, and it'll swallow in lots and lots of stars, like thousands of stars at a time. So everyone's a bit scared of it. Like every alien race doesn't, you know, every alien race is scared of it, and they're all trying to sort of stop people, anyone touching, because anytime you go near it or touch it, it expands a bit more, and you've got to go, oh, okay, there goes another 20,000 stars into the void. Again, I'm being a bit blithe about it, but it is set up well in the book. So anyway, outside of the void, someone called Inigo, he picked up messages from someone inside of the void, because years and years ago there was some people, human people, who actually managed to go into the void, and they set up their own civilization on a planet there. Of course, I'll get more into what happens inside the void later on in this review. But first of all, let's talk about the Commonwealth, the book, or the sort of human sphere of influence outside of the book. So Inigo, a human, he picked up these messages from inside the void from a survivor of this spaceship, which somehow managed to get in there. And he spread knowledge about what's inside the void. So of course, Inigo sets up this kind of religion cult kind of thing. And they're doing their best at this point of the story to get back into the void, or to go on a pilgrimage along with millions of their followers to go inside the void. Or to get there in the spaceships and get inside. So it's a bit tricky that way. And the thing is, if they go into the void, they might just die on the way there, and if they don't get shot down by aliens, other aliens on the way in there. The thing is, if they do get into the void, the void will expand massively to accept them and suck in masses more stars. And if too many people try and enter it, everyone's worried that the entire galaxy is going to get sucked into this void. Again, all of this is set up in the first book quite well. And the second book, Peter F. Hamilton's The Temporal Void, that I'm reviewing now, continues on this theme. So, of course, in the first book, they had lots of factions of humans wanting the pilgrimage to go ahead for their own reasons. Maybe they're part of a cult. Maybe they've got other reasons to want to go ahead. And then, of course, all the other factions of humans want to stop them. And of course, every other species of aliens in the whole galaxy wants to stop them as well. So it gets a bit complicated. Lots of power plays going on there. Lots of people pushing forward. Lots of people trying to hold them back. Meanwhile, there's someone outside of the void who is called the Second Dreamer. Because not just Inigo receives dreams. There's someone else, the Second Dreamer. And of course, they can somehow communicate their dreams through technology that I talked about in the previous episode on this book. So anyway, I don't need to go into it now. But the point is that everyone is looking for this Second Dreamer, because their Second Dreamer can communicate directly with the void, and they can go when the void pilgrimage goes there, they can say open up, and they'll open up, and the pilgrimage will be let through. Or the Second Dreamer can say don't let anyone in, and it won't let anyone in. So that's the thing. The Second Dreamer has a lot of power, and of course in the first book she, because it was Amarinta? I can't remember her name now. Amarinta, and she was obviously the Second Dreamer in the first book. You knew it right from the beginning, because like I said, she had no other role in the book except to be this character. Anyway, so everyone's looking for her, and in the first book she didn't realise she was the Second Dreamer, and now she realises she is in this book. So of course, everyone's trying to track her down. Meanwhile, other people are trying to track down the first dreamer who went missing, called Inigo, and he's been being tracked by a mysterious agent called Aaron. And then there's returning characters like Paula Mayo, who was trying to track down lots of people, because she's a super detective. And then there's Delivery Man, who works for the faction, who wants to keep everything the way it is. And then there's Marius, who's always trying to stir things up. And then there's Oscar, and he's trying to track down the Second Dreamer as well. And then there's a character called the Cat, who is just being her. Again, I'm not going to spoil it anywhere. And there's other people who are representing different factions as well. There's this one person that Aaron met right at the beginning of the first book, and she's not made a return yet. And I'm thinking, okay, who does she work for? And who does this person work for? Who does that person work for? So, whole long list of names of different agents working for different factions and different things there. But one thing I really do like about all of these people is that they're all super capable. They're all professionals. They've all got lots of skills, and they've all got lots of technology, and they've all got lots of things that they can do. And each time they meet each other, it's always like, okay, they're all professionals. They're all top, and you don't know who is going to come out on top in any one of these situations. And sometimes the bad guys, or, you know, in quotes, bad guys come out on top, and sometimes they don't, you know. So it's very much the same as as the Judas Unchained and the Pandora's Star kind of thing, that you're not quite sure who's working for who, who's representing who, or who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. And that's really quite cool. Also, I did notice here that all of the characters meet and, well, they'll all meet and interact with every other single character in the book at least once over the course of the trilogy. Because that's the kind of thing that Peter F. Hamilton does. Hamilton does this in his books because, and I was thinking, okay, does he really do this? Is it just this whole web where every timeline interacts and intersects every other timeline and every other character's story at least once, or maybe once or twice at the most? And I was thinking, oh, it seems like that when I read it, because it's like really complex and there's all of these timelines that are weaving in with each other. Really nice, really satisfying to read it. And I thought, okay, but maybe I'm just on my head there. And then I was reading this book and it references things, characters and events that people have met or experienced in the previous books, in Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. And it's like Oscar will meet someone and say, oh yeah, I once met this guy. And he said, did you really meet him? It's like, yeah, but I only met him once. And then someone else will say, oh, I met this guy, but only once, you know, it was just in there. And I'm thinking back, I thought, yeah, but they were fighting side by side and they were doing that on the same side of the cause. Of course they met each other more than once, but then thinking about it, no, they didn't. And I really like this, that, you know, looking back on it, you'll realise that all of these characters do only ever come into contact with each other once. I'm not saying it's a bad thing or a good thing, it's just that that's the way that Hamilton's stories seem to be structured in a quite satisfying way, I think. So, another character, Justine, she returned from the previous books as well. She manages to get inside the void, and she has her own experiences there, which are very closely tied to things that happened to her in Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. So, again, this is one of the another lines, or one of the other things that went, okay, you really have needed to have read the previous books to go on what happened, you know, to work out what happens here. For example, she sees this big storm on a world, and she says, oh, there's a big chunk out of this massive, like, cyclone tropical storm thing. She goes, what cuts a big hole in a tropical storm? And I'm like, oh, I know, it's a big mountain. And of course she goes down, it is a big mountain. Again, I'm not giving anything away here if you've read the these previous books. But it's those little things where you'll recognise all these hints and these other events and these other stories that are referenced, and you will have needed to read the previous books. So, unfortunately, if you've not read them and you've already started the Dreaming Void, I'd say just go back and read the other ones. You'll understand it a lot more. And also, another thing that happened was that Aaron, you know, this mystery man who doesn't know his own identity, is like, well, who is he working for? And you realise, okay, he's not working for that one. And about a quarter, maybe a third of the way into the Dreaming Void, I was like, oh, he works for this guy. And then, of course, by the end of this book, it turns out he is actually working for that guy. And of course, if you've read these previous books, you'll be able to work these things out. But it's very satisfying because it's like it's not being given to you on a plate, whereas if you work it out in advance, it actually makes you as a reader, or me as a reader, it makes me feel quite clever. Also, I just made a note here on my notes as well. The cover of the book. What I really liked about the first book is that the cover of the book showed this big spaceship descending and landing outside a house on a big lawn somewhere. And I was thinking, oh, okay, nice cover, but this is going to give away like the end of the book. But it didn't. It gave away something that happened in the first chapter, or in like the fourth page of the book. An alien spaceship comes down and lands outside a human home on Earth. And I was like, oh, that's pretty good. Same thing happened in this one. On the front of it, it's got a purple spaceship above a lava field. And I was reading the book, and it gets to sort of page 5, and it said she got into her purple spaceship and took off from the lava field, or the collapsing planet as the planet collapsed. And I was like, well, hey, that's the beginning of the book. So I really like this. I think more science fiction books should do this. Pick a scene that happens in the first like 3 pages of the book or 4 pages of the book, and have your cover of your book about that. Or about nothing in particular. But yeah, so many books of the covers. Again, that was the thing. My last review that I did was of Nightfall. And of course, everyone knows the story. But the front of the book shows an eclipse. And of course, the big thing that they're working towards is an eclipse. And yeah, so book covers sometimes give stuff away. But not these books, which is good. Okay. Two big questions that I had in my mind at the end of The Dreaming Void, the first book in this trilogy, was, why does everyone want to go to the void? Because, you know, life is fun. Life seems fun there, but it doesn't really seem that special. The second big question is, why does the void expand so much? And why does it sort of happen at a random event? Suddenly, why does it suddenly get bigger? And things like that. And we never really understand that. It was never explained. So, these questions are not answered in the actual world of the book that I've talked about so far, the stuff that happens in the Commonwealth. These books are these questions are answered. Oh, I'm all over the place tonight. These questions are answered in the part of the book which explain what happens in the Void itself, the story of Ediard. And Ediard is this young policeman, young constable in a city of Macathran, which is on the human planet inside the Void. And of course, the dreamers, the Inigo, got all this story in his dreams. And they're set out in like the alternate chapters of the book called Inigo's Fifth Dream, Inigo's Sixth Dream, etc., etc. So, in the Dreaming Void, we read of Ediard's childhood, and he was in a small town. He was driven away from a small town, and he went to the big city, and he became a policeman, and he was chasing like the petty criminal elements in the city. And at the end of the last book, we realise sort of like a small glimpse into his true powers and why he was called the Water Walker, because that's what everyone outside of the Void refers to him as, the Water Walker, and we understand why he's called that. And in this book, his story continues. You know, he rises to power in the city, and he gets more involved in the politics, and he clashes not with the petty criminals, but with the higher levels of criminals and corruption in the city. And again, I don't really want to go into too many details, otherwise I'll start spoiling it. Thing is, the world inside the Void doesn't have the same rules of the universe. It doesn't have the same rules of physics as the world outside the Void. So it's very much like a fantasy novel. It's like reading a fantasy novel. There's telepathy and telekinesis and all these other kinds of things. And Ediard happens to be, you know, like the young boy from the village who goes on a quest and realizes the true, you know, scope of his powers and things like that. Although he's very much the main guy. He's the one with most powers. His knowledge of the range of skills possible is quite limited, and he gets to know the range of skills that are actually possible, all these telepathy and telekinetic skills that he has. He learns them throughout the book here in the Temple Void. The thing is, in the Dreaming Void, in the first book in this trilogy, I really enjoyed these sections with Ediard because they seem to be very innocent. It's sort of like, okay, we've got this hard science fiction stuff, lots of spaceships going around, lots of big battles and stuff, and then we take a switch and we're in this sort of like very, very nice, very, you know, pleasant kind of fantasy world. It's like a big break from science fiction into sort of like a quite conventional in some ways, but you know it's going to be backed up in some way by science fiction principles kind of fantasy world. And I really enjoyed them. They were like a nice break. However, in the Temple Void, the bits outside the Void, in the Commonwealth, in the human outside Void kind of area of space, they don't take up very much action at all. Of course, we find out a bit more about the big conspiracies, and there's some key events take place, and other characters meet each other, but they seem to be like in a holding pattern, that part of the book, while, you know, Hamilton, he's really concentrating on Ediard's story in this book. And while I liked it in the first book, my main complaint here is that the fantasy worlds, it just takes too long, and it's really overwhelming, and the chapters of Ediard, they become a bit repetitive. Okay, he gets this bit of power and he does this and he moves up, and then something happens to him and he gets behind, and then he manages to get back and he wins that battle. And then the next chapter he does that, but just with a little bit more. And then the next chapter he does it again in a little bit more. And it just carries on like this, and it just seems to drag, you know. And yeah, and the other stuff with Paula and Aaron and the outside, you know, and the other characters, and Amanita and all these other characters in the outside wider galaxies, we go there and then just a little bit, just a few pages, and then we go back and have another 100 pages at the Ediard and sort of clashing heads with corrupt politicians, and then that takes ages, and then we go back and we have like a few little pages, and then we go back to Ediard again. And it just really dragged, and I think one of the main reasons that it dragged is because myself, as a reader, I don't know what's going to happen with the story of Ediard. I don't know what happens at the end of his story, although there's hints about it. I'm finding out as I go along. Whereas the characters in the rest of the book, they already know what Ediard has gone through because they've accessed Inigo's dreams. So I'm keep thinking, like, what am I going to find out about the Void, which is so important by reading this, that nobody outside the Void needs to consider? You know, and they're not mentioning what happens to him at the end of the story, so it can't be that important. So I was thinking, what am I bothering reading this? And so I was drifting along, and I wasn't really engaged with the book at this point, and I was saying to my girlfriend as well, I was like, oh, I'm not really sure, you know, I'm not really, you know, it's taking me a while to get into this book, you know, because it was getting to the end. And then Ediard finally leaves the city, and he goes off on this quest, and I'm like, what is he doing? It's obviously a trap that he's getting into. And then suddenly, all hell breaks loose and just things go completely mad, and I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? And Hamilton, he breaks out his Deus Ex Machina stride, you know, he goes for it, and I'm thinking, wow, this is a bit early. Normally he does this at the end of the third book, not at the end of the second book. And because I, you know, and I also said at the end of the last review that I know at the end what's going to happen is Hamilton is going to turn one guy into a god, and he's going to use his power to set everything right again. It turns out I seem to know Hamilton's themes and ideas pretty well, because that's pretty much what happens here. The only question is who's going to turn into the god by the end of the book. And of course, in this book, it's a bit obvious. But then, despite that, he seems to like grab hold of it, twist it all around, and suddenly all my characters, all the character questions that I had seem to be answered, and all the questions that I had before, these other ones like why do people want to go into the void and why does the void keep expanding, suddenly they're all answered as well, and now I know why the pilgrims want to go into the void and all these other things. And he did bring it round, and it suddenly all made sense, and it wasn't so much of a deus ex machina as I expected and things like that, so he did bring me round. But then I'm thinking, wait a second, all the other characters already knew this, they already knew what was going to happen, so now I'm wondering why anybody thinks it's a good idea for the pilgrimage to go ahead. And I'm wondering why more people aren't trying to stop it. It's sort of like the cult is, or this religion is going, okay, we want to go on this pilgrimage. Why isn't like the entire rest of the human race and the entire rest of the galaxy trying to stop them? Because, you know, if I was an alien, I would certainly try and stop them. I would wipe out the humans if they're going to try and wipe out the galaxy. And of course, that kind of thing is going on. There is an invasion fleet coming to Earth space, you know, Commonwealth space, to try and stop the pilgrimage going ahead. But yeah, that's it. You know, I was thinking, why aren't more people talking about this invasion coming in? Why aren't more people doing more to stop this? Why is it just these factions doing it? Why isn't the whole population up in arms about this? But I guess we just don't see things from their point of view in this book. So I think that it all comes down to there's some big pacing issues with this book, which, again, you sort of expect that with the sort of second part in the trilogy. But and by the end, I was a lot happier than I was just before the end. It sort of did bring it out, and I was a lot more satisfied. So hopefully I've just explained what I liked about the book and what I didn't like about a book without spoilers. I hope so. Anyway, so finally on to some of the themes of the book. Like I said, the first book was all about power and gaining power and staying in power. Very, very clear there. This book, though, is all about the use of power. And again, it's very clear. It picks up on lots of current news events as well. For example, there's sort of like occupation of unwilling population, and there's abductions of suspects from the street, like grabbing people from the street and interrogating them without cause, and maybe they're not the right people as well. Again, you can pick out these from the news stories recently. And also there's like, you know, whether covert surveillance is allowed or should be allowed and things. And of course, torture is a big thing in this book, as well as like shock and awe and overwhelming force and many, many other things. All these like touchstones that have come up in the use of power and the abuse of power over the past few years are explored very well in this book. And as though to drive the point home, quite a few characters actually use the line, sometimes you've got to do something wrong in order to do something right, or sometimes you've got to do wrong in order to do right. And again, to be honest, Hamilton really didn't have to like clunk us over the head with this, you know, because I think the themes in the book and the way that I was exploring them really spoke loud enough for themselves. Again, because it's like just reading the book shows you this point. You didn't have to have the major characters actually saying it. Also, because of this whole kind of use of power and absolute power corrupts absolutely and all that kind of stuff, I seem to have lost all respect for Eddyard as a character. In the first book, I really liked him. He had this innocence and it was going on an interesting story. In this book, I'm like, wow, he is a real bastard. I really don't like him at all. And I was annoyed that I had to spend so much time with him. Of course, Hamilton is doing this intentionally, and you can certainly see what kind of journey Eddyard is going on. And of course, while his story does seem to be wrapped up mostly by the end of this book, I can see that by the end of the third book, probably Eddyard is going to go further on that kind of Darth Vader kind of journey and maybe turn less good. I don't know. I'm just sort of seeing where his sort of character arc is going in this place. So I think that's probably about it for this book. And I've really not even scratched the surface, but I'm going to stick to my I'm not going to spoil this book kind of policy. And don't worry, the next book in this series won't come out for another year at least. So I guess that the next time I'm going to review one of the Void books and do a very, very vague review won't be for a long time yet. Although, again, a long time between these books. I last read the book, I think it was back in September, and this one I read here in January. And the next one doesn't come out until 2010. It's called The Evolutionary Void. I just looked it up online on the Wikipedia page there. And when I actually started reading this book, I didn't forget any of the characters. I knew who everyone was, but I was like, what are these guys doing again? Like, for example, Oscar. I'm like, okay, I remember who Oscar is, and I know what he's meant to be doing. It's like, but where is he again? And who are these members of his team? It's like, oh yeah, they're the Guardians. And then it was like, and who's this again? I was like, oh yes, of course, that's where they are. right, okay, Troblum's here, that person's there, Paula Mayo's going after this person. And while I remembered all the characters and I could pick it back up, it did take quite a few, quite a little bit to get into it. And that's why I realised, you know, they have the sort of previously on 24 kind of things, you know, this person's doing this, this person's doing this, and you may remember this person doing this. And one of those things at the beginning of the book might be really handy. Although what I'll probably do by then is when I pick up the Evolutionary Void, I'll go back onto the Wikipedia page or onto the Amazon.com page for the Temple Void and read what happened in there. And I'll be like, oh yeah, I remember. But I don't think I'm going to forget what happened at the end of this book, because it is a lot more key. It's a lot more world-changing than the things that happened at the end of the Dreaming Void. So, overall rating for this book, 3.5 stars. The last book I gave 4 stars, but this one, like I said, it didn't really click with me quite so much. The pacing was off. And there was just too much of interior to the Void's kind of stuff. He could have, like, for example, Ediard, he does this and he does that and he fights with this person and he fights with that person and he meets this person and he has sex with that person and he has sex with that person and then he has sex with that person and then he doesn't have sex with that person. And, you know, there's a lot of that kind of thing going on there. It's just like, okay, I don't really want to read so much about some 20-year-old kid wizard kind of thing. I want to read more about actual stuff that's going to have a lot of more impact. And I reckon you could have got to the main impact at the end of the book probably with about 100 less pages of Ediard's story. But anyway, that's the main point that I hit. So, next book that I'm going to read is, I've already started reading, is Gateway by Frederick Pohl. And the reason I'm going to read this is because one of the bits of feedback that I had from last time was that my reviews are a bit harsh recently. Maybe I'm a bit too harsh on the books. And I think it's recently I've been a bit harsh on those books because I've not read that many really good books recently. I've had like this big long run of books which are hanging around 1 star to 2.5 stars, and of course I've got a lot to be harsh about there. So I don't think I've been harsh at all about Peter F. Hamilton's The Temple Void, and I won't be harsh about Gateway because I've read it before. It's probably one of my favourite science fiction books, although I've not read it for many years. Of course, it won the Hugo and Nebula Award in the same year, so it's a bit of an obvious choice as a favourite book. But that's what I'm going to go for. Frederick Pohl's Gateway, classic science fiction once more. So, thanks of all for listening. If you've got any feedback, please email me, luke@juggler.net, or put future book recommendations on the sfbrp.com wiki. There's quite a few more suggestions being entered there. People want the Gap series, which I think I read the first book in the Gap series. Actually, let me just bring up SFBRP, the wiki, see what other books people have been recommending. Of course, I've got lots of books here with me, let me just check here some of the recent book recommendations. We've got Permutation City by Greg Egan, Rainbow's End by Verna Vinge. I've not read that, so I look forward to doing that. Yeah, The Gap series by Steve Aldonison, Altered Carbon by Richard K. Morgan. I'll probably read that next after that. Stainless Steel Rat, the first book in the series. I've never actually read any Stainless Steel Rat, so I'll probably go with that one. And of course, some Hyperion books. And someone's asking me to read the Night's Dawn trilogy, and I'm not going to read that because, again, really good books up until the end of the third one, and then the end of the third one you're going, oh man, you could have wrapped that up in a bit of a better way. And another stuff by Arthur C. Clarke that people want. So yeah, of course I'll be trying to find some of those books in the future and reading them. So of course I do actually I do read books that are reviewed. No, I do review books that are recommended to me on these pages as well, although it happens slowly because I have to fit them in with other books that I'm reading for my own enjoyment as well. So yeah, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you back here next time.